Daniel chapter 8 says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the capital, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Belai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. As I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth, without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken. Instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. It grew great even to the host of heaven. And some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. And a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of the transgression. And it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, for how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary will be restored to its rightful state. When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it, and behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end. And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up. He said, behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation. For it refers to the appointed time of the end. As for the ram you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. And the goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. And he shall cause fearful destruction, and shall succeed in what he does, and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints by his cunning, or it could be said by the holy, who are the holy. By his cunning he shall make deceit proper prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great. Without warning he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true, but seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now. And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I arose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it. We are in Matthew chapter 24 still. And as it says, I want to back up and take a running start at this today. I want to, because it's very, very, very important that we understand and we remember what's going on in the context, and we actually read the words on the page of the scriptures, because there is we're entering a danger zone of imposing an interpretation on what's here. So let's try not to do that. And then, so to remind you, Jesus has been, okay, so even to like, let's go way back. So remember, triumphal entry, Palm Sunday, etc. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, right? Everybody with me? That's going to become important. All right, so if we go from there, we got Jesus during that week. We're still in that week up until crucifixion, right? We hadn't got there yet. We haven't got the Passover, Lord's Supper. We're before all that. Everybody with me? All right, so Jesus has been going to the temple each day. Remember, he's going back to Bethany, back and forth. He went by the fig tree a couple times. Okay, so he's been going to the temple. He's been getting, they've been trying to trap him. He's been thwarting all their efforts. And we get to chapter 23. And Ben, last week, went over the, Jesus is, I don't want to impose anything on you know, what he's thinking, because it doesn't tell us what he's thinking. I'm sure it was all completely righteous and everything, but there is such a thing as righteous indignation. He's been taking all these attacks, and now he has basically said, he's throwing out the woes. He's saying, no. Okay, I'm done with this. Woe is you. And who is the you?
The hypocrites, the Pharisees,
which basically means the Jewish leaders, and it means everybody who's following them as well. So, but specifically, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, these people who have been not only attacking him, but leading the people of Israel astray, if it were possible. Another little hint where we're going. So, woe is you, woe is you, woe is you. Seven, eight, is that?
Eight.
Eight woe is yous. We come to verse 34 of Matthew 23. If I got it right, it's the last woe, inside the last woe. He says, woe is you, and he says in verse 34, therefore, I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, so that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of innocent Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Barakiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. And truly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. I'm sure that Benjamin said this already last week, but the Abel, obviously in Genesis we have Abel, and then in the last book of the Hebrew Old Testament, not necessarily in our last book as it's arranged, but in their last book, I think it's Second Chronicles is the last one, and there, as they go through, it speaks of Zechariah, son of Barakiah. So as it was an indication of, From beginning to end, it was a figure of speech. It was also, yes, absolutely everybody in that span. But as you read here, it's not done yet necessarily. The cup is not quite full yet as Jesus speaks this, right? And so there's been more who have been attacked, rejected, persecuted, killed by these, by the scribes and Pharisees, Jewish leaders, even since Zechariah. So, in a sense, that's, you know, like I said, that's, it doesn't stop at, it didn't stop at Zechariah. And he's saying, therefore, I send you. That is present and ongoing. As I send you. So, not only were there more from Zechariah, there's going to be more from when he says it right now. He says, I'm sending, basically he said, I am sending you. Or I send you. That's a present, ongoing kind of thing. So, he says, because of this, all these things, these woes, come upon this generation. Now, but he's not done yet. He says, he goes on, he says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, and he laments that they would not do what? They would not come under his authority. He says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. When he says Jerusalem, he's obviously not just, you know, talking about everybody within the walls. He's talking about Jerusalem as a representative of the nation. And specifically, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, as a representative of Judaism, of the Pharisees, the scribes, the leaders who are not following the actual spirit of God's law and instead imposing their own hypocritical ideas and leading what? Leading other, making a proselyte and leading them astray. We read about that, right? So, he's saying, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets. So, it's the system, the unrighteous system and nation, all those in it. And he says, see, your house is left to you desolate. All right, desolate. Desolate means what? Without hope? I mean, lots of things. But I'm assuming you went over desolate. I didn't get a chance to hear it, but...
I did.
You did? Okay, desolate. We're going to talk about that again because I haven't even got to yours yet. But we're going there. So it's your house, your here is Jerusalem. We've already defined who Jerusalem is. It's broader than just the city. But Jerusalem... the city and the house there is what? The house there, representative of all I just described, would be the house, the temple. Your house is left to you desolate. Okay. And he goes on, though. He doesn't stop there. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Remember what happened when he came in on Palm Sunday? The crowds gathered. They threw the palms on the ground, their cloaks on the ground. He's coming in, riding on the donkey, the colt of the foal of a donkey. And they're crying out, Hosanna, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And what does Jerusalem do? What do they say in response to this? Do they say, oh, well, maybe we should consider this? No, they say, why are these people saying this about you? Jesus says, if they didn't do it, the stones themselves would cry out, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And what he's saying now is, and so are you going to say it at the appointed time. So here we go. We've ramped up. We're now entering chapter 24. So Jesus is leaving the temple. Dan did this. He's leaving the temple, going away. And the disciples point to the temple. And what do they say? They just point. It doesn't say. It doesn't tell us exactly what they say when they point at the temple. But we get an impression about what they were trying to say. That's not what I wanted to show you. I wanted to show you some pictures of the temple. Can y'all see that? How about that? Is that good enough? Pictures of the temple. I mean, not like literal pictures of the temple. We don't have any like photographs of the Harris Temple, but probably what the temple was like. Okay, the point here is to tell you that there was a good reason that they would say, look at this temple. There's like all these buildings and everything. So look at this. This is amazing. And they might have been thinking. I mean, maybe they were. I don't know if they were thinking. If they were thinking, how's this? Maybe they. I'm not sure they got what he said at the time. He said, "I'm going to leave your house desolate." I'm not sure they really got that he was talking about the temple. But as they're leaving, they're like, "Hey, look at this temple," and it was a magnificent structure. Even Herod's temple was awe-inspiring. Solomon's was even more awe-inspiring. The scriptures say that the old men wept when they saw the new temple because they could remember the old temple. It was that much difference. And yet, they talk about how it was made of this limestone, and it was situated such that when the eastern sun rose in the morning, it shining, glared off of it so bright you could hardly look at it at times. It was like an amazing, amazing structure. Even Herod's temple was. I got a little video right quick here. I'm gonna play a little bit of it. And this, by the way, is a wonderful video. If you have any interest in the fall of the Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70, be glad to send you a link. I got the little timestamps written down, so I wouldn't have to watch it to 34. Yeah, give me some volume. Well, yeah, give me some volume, because he talks a little bit here. Kind of. This video, if you want the link, just let me know. I'll send it to you. It's an animation of Rome and the whole siege of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. Apparently, it's based on Josephus' account. As far as I know, it's pretty accurate. I haven't gone and like looked at it compared to Josephus, but from what I understand about it, it seems pretty accurate. So I was going to play this. This kind of shows their little animation of the temple.
The Romans held the north, the Jews the south.
Hang on, too loud. How do I turn this down?
See that volume thing?
Yeah. Well, that's not good. Why are you buffering?
Sides were prepared for a fateful duel within the enormous gladiatorial arena that was the Temple Mount complex. In the center of the battlefield was the linchpin of the Jewish defenses, the Inner Temple. Just like the Temple Mount, the temple was surrounded by a wall with wide fighting platforms atop a series of perimeter colonnades. The eastern half of the compound was known as the Court of Women. This was then connected to the western half by another wall and the Corinthian Gate. On the other side lay the Court of the Israelites, and beyond that, the Court of the Priests. At the very end lay the Holy of Holies, a 45-meter-tall, white marble edifice adorned with enormous golden gates and topped by golden points. This was said to be the very house of God, in which only the high priest entered on the Day of Atonement. In fact, the entire inner temple was normally off-limits to all but a select few. Extraordinary circumstances, however, call for extraordinary measures, and the holy spaces today were packed with defenders.
All right, we're going to stop there for now. All right, so the disciples are like, "Hey, look at all this, look at all this." And Jesus says, "You see all this? Not one stone will be left upon another." Basically. And this is as they're in Jerusalem. They're kind of apparently on their way out, or they're just still there. And then, so they leave the temple because it says they sat on the Mount of Olives. And I can just imagine the disciples going, thinking about what Jesus just said. And also, maybe they're starting to connect the dots a little bit because they get these woes. They got this, your house will be left desolate. And Jesus just says, all this is going to be torn down. Now, I'm not quite ready to give them, okay, we got to be careful because we've got all this information in the Word of God. And the disciples didn't have all the information that we have. So we have to be careful that we, you know, when they start asking these questions, we don't assume that they're coming at it necessarily with with as much information as we think they are. I don't know. I don't know exactly what all they had in their brains. I know what they asked, and that's what's important. But the reality is that in a few days, Peter's going to draw his sword and try to cut off somebody's head. And so I'm not entirely convinced that they're not still looking for an earthly messianic ruler. And when Jesus says all these stones will be thrown down, they're not sure. I'm not sure if they think he's like just saying a big metaphor, like all these stones, you know, this is all going to be destroyed in the sense that I'm going to destroy all these false rulers and I'm going to take over and I'm going to destroy the Romans and they're, I don't know exactly if they're like really completely on board yet. So, anyway, they asked, and, you know, they're obviously enamored with this temple. I mean, it's a imposing and sort of glorious structure, but you know, it makes me think that maybe they're still not quite focused on the real thing, and they're not quite yet getting it yet. And it's okay, because you know Jesus hasn't even had the resurrection yet. So anyway, they're going to ask their question, and Jesus is going to respond, and he's going to say, you know, this thing's going to be destroyed. So if the temple is destroyed, this was the center of like the most important things for the Jews. What would not be able to be done? What would be lost if the temple was destroyed? The whole sacrificial system would be lost. So they didn't do sacrifices anywhere except Jerusalem. At the temple. They didn't do them at the synagogues or anything like that. The whole time they're in exile, they weren't doing sacrifices. When they came back from exile, what was one of the first things they wanted to do? Build the temple back. Of course, they also wanted to build the walls back at the same time, but building the temple back. So it was extremely important. So disciples, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they were confused. So they asked their questions. When will these things happen? Jesus has just said what? Just said, not like just said like right before they asked this, because I think they were likely still in Jerusalem when they were looking at the edifices and saying, hey, look at all these beautiful buildings. And he says, hey, every stone is going to be thrown down. And they walk, now they're on the Mount of Olives. And they ask, well, when are these things going to take place? When are they going to take place? What will be the sign of your coming and the close of the age? Now, these three questions are really all about the same thing. So, again, let's think about this. We're fixing to hear a lot of information in Matthew 24. But if you will look, remember we have the Synoptic Gospels. Remember we have the Synoptic Gospels that also give us similar accounts of the same things happening. And interestingly, in Luke, much of what we're fixing to read in 24 and in the 35, which is one continuous thought. Did I say 35? 25. 24 and 25. Some of that you find in Luke 17, and some of that you find in Luke 21. Now, it appears when you read through Luke, some of this information was talked about, and then later on, some more is talked about. I find it very possible and probable that this is not necessarily the first time Jesus has like mentioned some of this information. If you read 17 in Luke, it's the same information that you find in Mark 13 and Matthew 24:25. It's not all the same information, but the information is the same. Is some of the information you find in these complete. I mean, like, complete is not the right word. Where it's given all at one time. Okay, so how many times have we told our kids or instructed them, and then we have to come back later, we have to give them the same instructions again? Okay? I mean, I'm thinking that's got to be going on with Jesus. He's got to be saying, and if you read 17, it's not quite as clear in the sense that the way Luke presents it, it's like he's teaching them about what's to come in a more of a general sense. Hey, this is going to happen. But when we read it in Matthew and Mark, it's like there's a lot more what you might call timestamps as to when exactly this is going to happen. It's like 17 and Luke is like, hey, this is going to happen. There's going to be this time of trouble, you know. And then he kind of uses the information to teach a little something about dealing with the time of trouble kind of thing, which was completely appropriate, but it was the exact same information he's fixing to give and tell exactly when this time of trouble is. So I think the disciples kind of maybe had a chance to like reflect on it. You know what? He said some things about it that might kind of go along with what he just said here. So they're like, so now they're like, hey, when is this all going to happen? You know, we kind of remember you talking about some stuff before. But is this what you're talking about now? When is this all going to happen? So, and again, we're on the front end of the crucifixion again, guys. So don't forget that very likely, they're still like thinking, earthly messianic king, get rid of the Romans kind of thing. I give them a lot of charity that hopefully they had a little bit bigger idea than just get rid of the Romans. That there was this humongous other aspect to it, because they were definitely being revealed more truth than those who did not have their eyes open. But they didn't completely have their eyes open yet, because we're going to find out all these other things later that they, oh, whoa, didn't realize that. So here they are asking these questions. Well, when is this going to happen? When is this destruction of the temple, whether it's like they're thinking, is this metaphorically or like, is it really going to be, you know, is he really going to tear the whole building down? And if he is, goodness, what would he build in replace of it? Because he's this messianic, potentially, you know, this earthly king. All right, so they say that, they ask these questions, and they ask all three of them together. Boom, boom, boom. Okay, so they need to be taken as like all one question, like three parts to one big question. Like, what is all this about? All right, so they ask their questions, and Jesus' first thing he says is in verse 4. See that no one leads you astray. So, in answer to their, when is this going to happen? His first priority is to say, listen to me carefully, so that no one tricks you. So no one leads you into false. So that, because, let me tell you, because this is going to be an important time, and I want good for you. So listen carefully, so that no one leads you astray. And then he goes on to tell them, like, hey, some examples of what might lead them astray, because there's going to be these false Christs. There's going to be wars, and you're going to be thinking, Jesus told us this is going to happen. Is it happening now? Is this the war? Is this it? He said, no, there's going to be these wars. There's going to be rumors of wars. There's going to be famines. There's going to be earthquakes. Are these those signs he was talking about? Because, and we're going to get to the signs later, but wars and famines and earthquakes, if they knew anything about the Tanakh, the Old Testament scriptures, then they should be recognizing those are the type of things that are talked about in the prophets. Those were the things that prophets said. There would be signs of God working, signs of God's power in nature, earthquakes, etc. And so he's telling them, don't be misled. You're going to see these things. There's going to be these people claiming to be me. Of course, Christ knows he's going to rise again, presumably. He knows he's going to rise again. I don't know how, as a man, he knows that. I'm not going to get into that. But, you know, I think he kind of knows what they're going to have in their back pocket, so to speak, as far as experience-wise. But he's saying, hey, be careful. Many are going to be misled. Don't be misled. So he keeps going through this first part of 24. And then he says, not only will there be these things happen that make you sort of wonder, did you miss it? Is this it, or did I miss it, or whatever? Not only is that going to happen, but there's also going to be personal attacks against you. And you're going to be put in extremely stressful situations, to say the least. Like, going to be imprisoned, going to be flogged, going to be crucified, he even says. If he doesn't say it exactly here, I can't remember. But just somewhere else he says they were crucified. So, put you to death, he says in the ESV. So, there's a whole lot going on. In fact, he says of these things that are, of these natural events, these are with the beginnings of the birth pangs. And so, he's going on, and he's wanting to be sure that they have everything they need so that they are not misled. And he says, and finally he says in 14, and this gospel of the kingdom, this proclamation of the kingdom, this good news, this birth announcement of the kingdom, will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Dan went over this very well last week, that this world is the Roman world. Paul talks about in Romans that the gospel had already been preached to the whole world. He talks about that in Romans even, when he wrote the letter to the Romans. And so, then the end will come. But end of what? Well, we're fixing to find out more information so they know what end they're talking about. He's talking about. And that's where we go in verse 15. So he says, and the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed through the whole world as a testimony to all nations. Then the end will come. So, because of this, when you see the abomination of desolation spoke of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Oh, that's the first thing he says after this. Don't be dismayed. But now, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. This is coming up. This is like we're getting closer and closer to the event. All right, so who is Jesus talking to now? Just remember, who is he talking to? He's talking to his disciples. And in 15, he says, so when you see the abomination of desolation, who's going to see it? The disciples are going to see it. All right. Who's he talking to? Now, so we talked about who might get misled. The disciples. Now, I think we're talking about more than the 12 possibly, because he had like disciples that were beyond the 12. So we're not necessarily just talking to the apostles, but we're not talking to the Jewish leaders anymore. He's not really mentioning the crowds. He just said the disciples came and asked these questions. So we're going to limit it to like his more close. They're on the mountain. So maybe it is just the 12. I don't know. It doesn't necessarily say that 100%. But so who might be misled? Who might be misled? The disciples. Who will hear of these wars? The disciples. Who might be frightened? The disciples. Who will undergo tribulation and be delivered up? The disciples. And what did Jesus say to the scribes and Pharisees? He said, I'm sending you even more. Who did he send? The disciples. All right. And the disciples, and I'm just going to jump ahead because we're fixing to talk about a whole bunch of stuff, and then we're going to get all the way down to 34. I'm just going to go ahead and read it, where it says, truly I say to you, same you he's talking to, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So, this generation is the disciples' generation. He's talking to them. He's giving them information that they're going to need because they're going to experience it and they're going to see these things. So, 15 says, so when you see, who's going to see it? Disciples are going to see it. When you see the abomination of desolation. All right. What does that mean? Abomination of desolation. Well, the word abomination means a detestable thing. And in the context of Israel and the Jews, the most detestable thing that they could see would be idolatry within sacred space. It's idolatry in general, but even more detestable than that would be idolatry somewhere that was supposed to be reserved for the worship of God. But there's multiple, you could read in the Psalms, he talks about what, this is abominable to me. So, ultimately, anytime we sin, what we're doing is raising up an idol in our heart, and we're going to that idol, and we're saying, I don't want to listen to what you say, God. I want to do what I want to do, and I want to do this. And that becomes an idol in our life. So, there's different things that are called abominations to God. It's just an idea that these are things that are detestable to God. Ezekiel 5:11 would be a verse that we could go to and read a little bit about this. I'll read it right quick. Ezekiel 5:11. Therefore, as I live, declares the Lord, surely because you have defiled my sanctuary with all your detestable things and with all your abominations, therefore I will withdraw. There's an abomination. They're talking about the detestable abominations in the context of defiling of the sanctuary. And honestly, that's why it's so important that as we consider the fact that we are the temple of God, that when we do something against His holy will, we are basically doing an abominable thing to the Lord. We are defiling the sanctuary of God. Okay? So, in this case, the abomination of desolation. And desolation means something that is appalling, horrific, or destructive. And you can say maybe the abomination, if it's the word of is not really there. It's abomination, desolation. So they kind of, to make it flow in English, we stick the word of in there, but it also could be accurate to put of the desolation. So it'd be the desolation, so it'd be like more of a noun there. It'd be like the destroyer instead of this destructive. The abomination of destruction, those all fit what desolation means. Anybody got a question or something to add there? Just trying to give you an idea about this. We don't use these terms much. So what does it mean, abomination of desolation? And it says, and what it tells us exactly, it is exactly if we understand, but it says it's the abomination of desolation that Daniel spoke of. Okay, there's four places in Daniel where he speaks of abomination of desolation. We read one in Matthew, in chapter 8 this morning. The other one is in chapter 9, 26 and 27. And after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. Well, I guess that was just desolation. The other one is Daniel 11.
Later on,
it does. Did I not go far enough? You have a question? Oh, okay. You want to read on to the...
You shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, and for a half a week you shall put an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abomination shall come one who makes desolate.
That's it. That's right. I didn't go far enough. I thought it stopped at 27, but it goes. So, then in chapter 11, way down at 31, there's another section here. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular. Do you ever notice the fortress aspect there? The member who was talking about this thing was built like a fortress. It had not just the temple, but around the temple were like fortress battlements and stuff. And shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. And then the last one is in chapter 12, the very end of chapter 12, 11. And from that time, the regular burnt offering is taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate is set up there shall be 1290 days. So I don't have time to get into like explaining all of Daniel. I just want to say, I'm just pointing out that the abomination and desolation, they're going together. In almost every one of these contexts, it's talking about a sanctuary that's defiled. So I'm going to leave it at that. There's a lot more there. So, abomination of desolation there. Now, the Jews thought that this happened in about the 2nd century B.C. because there was this Roman, I think it's Roman general, and Antiochus. I think that's how you say that. Antiochus. Yeah, Antiochus. However, the problem with that is that we're told right here in Matthew's gospel that who's going to see this? Disciples are going to see this. They weren't there, so that wasn't it. Okay? I mean, this is quite simple. I'm not saying that what he did was not an abomination. But it wasn't the abomination of desolation that Daniel was talking about. Because Jesus says right here, the one Daniel's talking about is the one you will see. Okay? So, now I'm going to put forward to you a couple of things. First of all, I want to go to Mark chapter 13, verse 14. I want to read what it says about the abomination of desolation. It says, but when, this is the synoptic of what we're reading, okay? This is Mark's version of the Olivet Discourse. But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not to be, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea fly the mountains. Okay, so Matthew says, in the holy place, those are his words. Mark says, where it ought not to be. Okay? Hang on to that. We're going to go to Luke and read what Luke says. It's in chapter 21 of Luke, verse 20. It says, but when you see, again, this is exactly the same, but when you see, and what he says is when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, etc. Okay? So it doesn't say abomination of desolation, but it says its desolation is near. And remember, Jesus said, I will leave your house desolate. Okay? Now, so we got the abomination of desolation will be in a holy place where it ought not to be, and it'll be when Jerusalem is surrounded by armies. That negates the 2nd century B.C. event, because Jerusalem was not surrounded by armies when that happened, from my understanding, nor were the disciples going to be there to see it. So we got some qualifications here. So everybody wants to know, or everybody's trying to figure out, everybody, but what was the abomination of desolation? Well, I would put forward, and according to my sources, I would be agreed with, if you care, by the church father, Chrysostom, Augustine, the likes of Spurgeon, and Barnes, would all go with this this idea. So the abomination of desolation, what would be an abomination? What would be the worst abomination? Of course, holy place could be, you know, I guess, the holy city, anywhere in the holy city theoretically qualifies a holy place for the Jews. For sure, the temple would be a holy place. Okay? And it's got to be when the Romans were surrounding the city. And it's got to be, what did I say? Where it ought not to be. The most likely place for that is in the temple. And it would be basically the worship of another god in the temple. And from what we know from various historical resources is that this is an example. This is what people understand. This is the Roman standard or ensign that they carried into battle, they would have had it in all their camps with surrounding the city with this. It has their eagle on the top. It generally had some sort of like maybe denoting what group it was for. And it generally had, this doesn't show it very well, that they, according to Josephus, it had an image of the Caesar underneath the eagle. And the army would, in the morning and in the evening, bow before the ensign in worship of Caesar. And so, from what I can tell, it's likely that this would be what was considered the abomination. When it was not just the piece of metal or the stick, it was the whole idea about it, that this was, that the Romans were going to come in, and they would come in and they would bring this with them, and they would plant it on top of the temple after they destroyed it, and even during the process, because they would be carrying it in battle, and then they were going to worship Caesar in the temple, in the holy place.
We culturally are familiar with World War II,
right?
The planting of the flag,
right?
The guys pushing the flag up,
Hiroshima and stuff.
Yeah, and the idea is that we have taken possession,
right? Right?
And so, at the point that they took the temple, they would have brought that in and said, "We own this place." That would be the kind of figure that I think you're trying to paint there.
Yeah. Well, and also it would be a final defilement of. Yes.
I think Josephus, I may be wrong, I think Josephus specifically said that they planted it in the Holy of Holies. That's the place where it didn't belong.
It didn't belong anywhere within Jerusalem. But
especially
yeah.
Only the high priest.
The video, and again, I'm assuming it's accurate, the video says that as they were trying in that final attack on the temple, the commanders were trying so hard to get the soldiers to go and to fight hard. They were taking these incense, which were considered sacred by them, and throwing them over the wall, that the soldiers would try to go and defend the incense. I think it's called an incense. And so they were throwing them into the temple, in a sense. They were like, it was like, go protect your God. And so they were, there was this. Let's see here. So, but this was a representation, though. So that you could actually expand the abomination with the whole Roman army. Was the abomination it was going to make desolate. So, Josephus actually says that after the temple was destroyed, they went up and put the incense on top of the rubble and declared. And then I think he even says they worshipped there. They bowed to their incense there. And so this would fit all the categories that we have in the scriptures regarding this. And also, I did not go so far in my studies to see if I could find this, where, because in my opinion, you have all of the discourses in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but people say, well, there's not one in John. Well, I think we might have talked about this before. In my opinion, the book of Revelation is John's all of the discourse, and if that's the case, we can probably find the abomination. I'm almost positive it's in there too, but I did not go there to find it when I was preparing this. So what's next? He says, you'll see this, and what are they to do when this happens? He says, flee to the mountains. Now, normally, if you're in a situation like this, and this is actually, I don't remember if the video said this or if I heard it somewhere else, but the city of Jerusalem was actually an incredibly well-fortified city. And normally, when the invading army would come in, because guys, We focus like on the destruction of the temple, and then kind of from that, they surrendered Jerusalem. They didn't just start there. They came in raping and pillaging all the country and all the other cities of Jerusalem, of Judea and Israel on their way to Jerusalem. So this was not just a little around Jerusalem problem for the nation. It was the whole countryside.
And they were intentionally sent to be to make an example. This they were to make an example of their attack on Jerusalem because and the of Israel because of the type of rebellion that had gone on and what had happened with the Caesar that had started to attack and then had to retreat. And his son Titus that actually came, it was to be an example to the world of the strength of the Romans.
Yeah, as my point is that when Jesus says flee the mountains, that would not be intuitively what you would do. You would intuitively flee to the fortress for protection, especially one like Jerusalem. The way they describe it, likely not many other cities in the world as well fortified as Jerusalem. And according to one, let's see here. I didn't write down everything that I read about to give. I can find it for you if y'all want it. But apparently Josephus talks about Titus proclaimed after everything was over, and he is able to get into the city and examine everything. Of course, he could see it from the mountains, but he got in there and examined it. And then, of course, he'd experienced what it took to capture the city. And he basically said, "There's no way we could have done this without a higher power." I mean, he might have been thinking about his gods, but the reality was that Jerusalem could have held out for years if there hadn't been a bunch of infighting and other things going on. In fact, at one point, one faction burnt like a whole year's worth of stored food of the other faction because they hated the other faction so bad. And all the time, Roman armies surrounding the city. This was how insane the people got by the hand of God. So, but anyway, Jesus says, flee the mountains. Now remember, wait a minute. What was the sign in what was it? And what did Luke, I think it was Luke. What would be going on? What was going to be going on when you see the abomination of desolation? Armies are going to have to be surrounded the city. Remember, there was wars and rumors of wars. If you're not familiar with this, there was actually two sieges of Jerusalem before it fell. There was a siege, I think you were like implying going this, there was a siege before the final siege. That was, what was Titus's father's name? Yeah, I should know it. It's like, right? It was incredibly well-known Caesar. Can't remember his name now. He was there. He had begun a siege of Jerusalem, and then there was all this turmoil and infighting within the Caesars and stuff, and he had to leave, and he sent Titus back to finish the job. Caesar, can't remember his name. Anyway, the point is that the part of the sign, Vespasian, right, part of the sign was that the city would be surrounded. Now, how are they going to flee to the mountains if they're, and the first of all, they got to be in the city to know what's going on, to see all the signs. Or they got to be close by anyway to know what's going on in Jerusalem. And the city's surrounded, how are they going to flee the mountains? Well, Josephus reports that for some unknown reason, after Cestius had the city surrounded, he actually withdrew for a time before the final siege was applied. Very interesting, because that would have given anyone who had followed the scriptures the chance to flee the mountains before the final siege. And there's a church father, Eusebius, lived about 250 to 350-ish AD. And he wrote, and this is the paraphrase. Again, I'll get you the original if you want it. He wrote, he said, this is his testimony. He says, the whole body of the church at Jerusalem, commanded by divine revelation that was given before the war, removed itself from the city and went and dwelt in a town called Pella. So we have an actual historical documentation of Christians who had not only Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but they had the book of Revelation. And all of them say, when you see the signs, get out of the city. Because Christ was protecting his people. He was protecting all the elect who listened to him and followed and believed. So while this stuff is written to the disciples for something that's going to happen to them in their lifetime, we can take comfort that Jesus did this for his people. So let's take that as a little application there. All right. So the instruction is flee the mountains. And they apparently did this before the final siege. Because according to Josephus, it's pretty incredible to read about it. At one point in the siege, they were sort of allowing people to sort of trickle out. But at one point, they said, no more. And they made a complete encirclement. And that anybody that came out, they would catch them and crucify them and stick them up so that everybody in the city could see them. They had crucifixions all the way around the city. All right, so he says next. So I'm in Luke still. Let me go back to Matthew. Let them flee to the mountains. And it talks about like how, you know, how important and how, like, don't even go, if you're on your rooftop working, don't even go back inside to get anything. Just get down and go. If you're out in the field, don't go home and get your coat. Just get down and go. Those are the next verses you're talking about. You know, and hope you're not pregnant, having to make this travel up in the mountains. That's not going to be fun. Hope it's not wintertime. Verse 21. Then there will be great tribulation, such as not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. So here we have the great tribulation phraseology. Great tribulation. To understand the degree of tribulation that the Romans could impose. And listen, so it says, for such has not been from the beginning of the world until now. So be careful we don't impose World War II or World War I on what he's saying. That's later. So the destruction Hiroshima is later. He says until now. And quite frankly, if you read about what the Roman armies were capable of and the cruelties that they could dish out, I believe that they devised new and great ways. Just think crucifixions of imposing a tribulation on people. At this point in the Roman history, it was near its peak. I mean, they were near the apex of Rome. Not quite, but they were at the top of the curve there.
And it does say, nor ever shall be, nor ever will be, at the end of 21.
Right.
But we're talking about suffering. We're not talking about amount of death.
Right, or destruction.
Because there is a difference between suffering and dying.
Right. Yeah, and there was incredible suffering within Jerusalem. And like I said, we talk about AD 70, we talk about destruction of the temple, destruction of Jerusalem, But they went throughout the whole of the nation, destroying cities, massacring, and other nations around where there were Jews still living. Remember, the Jews had come back from Babylon, but a lot of them were still, they got dispersed at Babylon, you know, when Babylon came, and some of them came back, but a lot of them stayed out. There were like Jews everywhere. There were synagogues in Antioch and in Syria, places like that. When the Romans came in, the word went around, we're destroying the Jews. All the other nations said, okay, let's do it too. So locally, all over the Roman world, the Jews were being attacked at the same time. But it was shortened for the sake of the elect. And I like the way it says it in Mark, chapter 13 of Mark. It actually is very clear. It says, and if the Lord had not cut short the days, no human being will be saved. But for the sake of the elect, whom he chose, lest you don't know what it means to be elect, Mark says, whom was chosen, he shortened the days. So really, like, that's pretty neat. I like that. Let me go back to Matthew. Oh, also, let's see here. So, in reference to the, let me see here. Before I go much further, I wanted to show this little clip. Did this thing cut off still? Okay. This little clip of, from the video here, of the final destruction. I'm gonna give you a little teaser here. Play a little bit from the first here.
The siege of Jerusalem was a massive military endeavor, the likes of which had not been seen since the fall of Carthage 2 centuries earlier. Starting in April of 70 AD and lasting nearly 5 months, the battle would be a brutal, no-holds-barred brawl fought over every inch of the city. At stake was the success of the Great Revolt in Judea and the survival of the Jewish people. Roman involvement in Judea first began in 63 BC when Pompey the Great was drawn into a Jewish civil war and eventually seized Jerusalem. However, the region saw much turbulence during the final years of the Republic and was taken over by the Parthians, before legions returned to install the puppet King Herod. Eventually, a series of procurators oversaw Judea, but these largely lacked the competency or military power to impose order.
Okay, that's all your teaser. If you want to see the rest of it, I'll give you the link. I do have a little section here that shows the standard. Find it.
Titus must have been unimaginably frustrated. Desperate for results, he ordered another storming of the walls. The results were predictably bloody. Roman troops climbing the ladders were dangerously exposed. Many found themselves toppled in their attempts to scale the walls, while others finally managed to reach the top under continual artillery and archer covering fire, only to be left isolated. Those that did make it up were vastly outnumbered and slaughtered. Roman centurions resorted to throwing legionary eagles onto the walls in a bid to motivate the proud soldiers to retrieve them.
That's what I was talking about before. And then the actual temple destruction, which is really the culmination, is, I'll give you a little snippet of that too.
Initiating the fourth battle of the temple. The engagement was similarly hard-fought, but the crush of a Roman counterattack managed to drive the defenders right up to the temple walls itself. Here, Jews atop the walls dislodged stones and threw down an assortment of projectiles onto the Romans. However, in the close press below, a pair of legionaries were seized by impulse. One grabbed a piece of flaming debris, while the other hoisted him up against the north side of the temple. From this elevation, he lobbed the burning timber through a low, golden door into the sanctuary chambers. In the summer heat, the highly flammable timbers and textiles took light. Thick, black smoke billowed into the air as fire spread rapidly, to the stunned amazement of both sides. The fire rapidly spiraled out of control, threatening to consume the countless sacred texts and treasures within the temple. The Jews were left paralyzed between choosing to fight the flames or the Romans. The legion seized on the initiative and plunged forward without orders. They battered down the eastern gates and penetrated the inner court of the temple. In this moment, at the climax of a grueling 3-month siege, the attackers gave way to their bestial nature. Soldiers broke free from their officers, controlled only by a toxic psychological state of repressed rage and frustration. Pity was the first casualty, soon followed by a butchery of all those who did not flee the hellscape. The young, the old, the helpless, all were put to the sword. This bloodlust would only be matched in intensity by...
So, this is what Jesus was warning them to flee from. Because the desolation, because the judgment was on the Jews, on the false Pharisees, scribes, etc. It was not meant for God's people, God's elect. So if we go on, we got verse 23. It says, if someone says to you again, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christ and false prophets will rise and perform great signs and wonders as if to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I've told you beforehand. If they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, don't go out. If they say, look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will it be. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there it says in ESV, the vultures will gather. So Josephus again, we go. To, he's again.
Do you want to talk about that vulture?
Yeah. He is a you know we're going to him. He's not inspired. He's not like. Everything he says isn't like detailed, accurate to the detail. A lot of this expanded upon, but generally speaking, we go to him, and he reports that there were false prophets who said, you know, in the midst of the chaos of the siege and other things, I know how to get out of here, follow me. And they would go out, to the wilderness. Josephus reports they would go out to the wilderness. And the Romans would see it happening or find out about it, and they would go out there and just slaughter them all. It was more than one time there were people trying to flee. But when the fleeing to the mountains was what Jesus said to do, don't follow the false teachers there. And so in verse 27 it says, like lightning will be the coming of the Son of Man. Now, if you think about lightning, what comes to mind? Swift, powerful, focused. But biblically, lightning is over and over used to describe judgment by military means most of the time. So, quickly, somebody get 2 Samuel 22, 14 through 15. Who's got it? Benjamin. Psalm 18:14. Zechariah 9:14. Habakkuk 3:11-12. Luke 10:18. Revelation 16:18-19.
What was that Zechariah one again?
9:14.
Thank you. What was that Luke one?
10:18. 3:11-12. 16:18-19. You need yours again, Hudson? Luke 19, good. You need yours again?
Sure. 2 Samuel 24.
22. Right, 14 through 15.
Okay.
Psalm 18, 14.
Revelation 16.
18 through 19. Go ahead, Benjamin.
So he made darkness around him as canopy, thick clouds, and gathered in the water out of the brightness before him. Coals of fire flamed forth. The Lord thundered from the heaven, and the Most High uttered his voice. He sent out arrows and scattered them, lightning, and routed them.
Okay. And that, in the context, there is a military judgment. Okay. Zechariah 9:14.
And the Lord shall be seen over them, and his arrows shall go forth as the lightning, and the Lord God shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with whirlwinds of the south.
Habakkuk 3:11-12.
The sun and the moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of thine arrows they went. And at the shining of the glittering spear. 11 through 12.
That's fine. I think it's the glittering is the word that has the idea of lightning in it.
Yes, but he says that the flash of your glittering spear.
Yeah. Luke.
And he said unto them, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven.
Okay. Revelation.
And there was noises, and thunderings and lightnings, and there were a great earthquake, such a mighty and great earthquake as had not occurred since men were on the earth. Now the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath.
Okay. So that's a vision that John had, and lots of symbols in there. But the lightning is a symbol of God's wrath coming in judgment, and generally through a military context, but not always military. So the lightning here is, I believe that's what it's talking about. And it says, then verse 28 is interesting. Verse 28 could be read this way: wherever the defeated are, there the eagles gathered. And really, it's quite interesting to me that this word, does the King James do vultures?
No,
it does eagles.
Okay.
I think NASB and ESV do vultures. And then, this made me just laugh, shake my head a little bit. Even if you go to Strong's, it'll say eagles, and then it says comma, or maybe vultures, since it's where corpses are. It's like, that's reading into what they think the word means, because but that's not what the word means. The Greek word is word for eagles. And does anybody get the connection there?
Roman eagles.
Let me throw the standard back up again. Eagles. And we don't even have to go far, but there's, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Hosea, I believe, is what that says. use the same word, Hebraic word, though. But and it's the same thing. It's a bird of prey, basically. And I don't see why we need to use the word. I think I'd go with the KJV this time. And eagles is okay. It's eagles. I mean, Jesus. What's Jesus trying to do here? He's trying to say, look, when you see this stuff, he's telling them exactly what to look for. Look for these eagles. Oh, eagles. So. So we got this. I want to stop for just a minute, because I got one more verse I'm going to do. But we've already had a bunch of symbolism. You know, we've had this thing called the abomination of desolation. It didn't tell you exactly, but it told you kind of what it was going to look like. But now we've had lightning. And it's not, we're not talking about the actual lightning. We're talking about lightning as a symbol. And now we've had eagles. We're not talking about the kind that fly. It's still a symbol. I think it's very reasonable that it was a symbol that could actually see an image of. We got to understand, because we're going into some things in 29 and to follow, that if you're looking for literalism, it doesn't fit. First of all, it doesn't fit. But what does fit is if you understand, and if you, and look, I'm not saying I got it all, because I can't point to verse and, you know, exactly maybe. But we're fixing it. If you understand and you've read Isaiah and Ezekiel and Daniel and the prophets in the Old Testament, the Tanakh, as it's called, if you've read those and you listen to what it says, you're going to find it. We're going to be going right into some very common prophetic apocalyptic imagery. It's coming up. It should not be taken any other way except that way. I don't think it should. And so in verse 29, it says, immediately after the tribulation of those days. Now, I want to say that he's been talking about, when you see this stuff, do what? Flee. Those are the days that were immediately preceding what we're fixing to learn about. Because what I'm telling you is, the temple actually hadn't fallen yet. The temple's still standing as we're going through this narrative that Jesus is talking about. The tribulation was leading up to that. It was the siege. It was all the problems that was causing. And there's fixing to be a great tribulation that you're supposed to flee from, which was the finishing out of the siege. And so now it says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. Then all the tribes over the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. When does this happen? Immediately after this tribulation time.
And before that generation passes.
And this generation will see this happen. So the tribulation, like I said, wasn't talking about all the way until everything was destroyed and Rome had gone back to Italy. Wasn't Italy then, it was Rome. It was talking about the tribulation, and then what's going to happen. Then you have all this apocalyptic language. The end.
Just to note, you know, if you close to the end, a little bit down, it says, all of these things will take place.
All of these things.
Before this generation passes.
Right. That's 34. I'm not even going to get there. I mean, I could get there pretty easy, because the fig tree is just saying, hey, it's just another, he's just saying, look, this is another thing to look to. This is just another little analogy. I'm telling you, when you see these things, it's like the leaves coming on the fig tree. You will know. You won't just have to guess, but you will know. Fig trees are actually one of those sort of, they sprout their leaves a little later in spring than a lot of things. Like, many times, you know, you'll have things that sprout their leaves and we get this cold snap. Winter's not quite over. Fig tree generally waits until it's pretty much a guarantee that we're not going to have any more cold snaps. So that's what he's saying. He's saying, not only will you, you see all this coming forward, and this is your warning to flee. Because it's not my intention to judge the elect. The elect have been, there's no condemnation for the elect. They're not the ones that are to receive this judgment. If they don't, now listen, if they don't obey and flee like Jesus said, they're going to have to go through it because of their disobedience. But that's not the intent necessarily of the destruction of Jerusalem. And so, when the fig tree puts out its leaves, you know that everything is near. And what do you know is near, according to verse 33? You know He is near. Jesus coming in judgment is what this is talking about. So, sun darkened, moon no light, stars falling. Apocalyptic language that that is very common. You go back, you can see all through Ezekiel and Isaiah and other prophets. And I think that stars falling is actually really quite interesting. And we could go, it's more than, it's like, it is apocalyptic language, but it's also descriptive language. And at other places, you talk, it's talking about stars falling, descriptive of supernatural powers being put down. Talking about like when Satan fell, stars fell with him.
And the precedent is what I'm hearing you say in the Old Testament. Precedent shows us that this same thing can be said. The event happens, but it wasn't the end of the world.
Well, obviously it wasn't the end of the world.
That's what I'm saying. So because of those past presidents, this doesn't have to be the end of the world either, based on my language.
Yeah, this language was spoke of like hundreds of years, like when Babylon came in. This is the same language this was used. And if literally the sun had darkened, it wouldn't. I mean, the earth would have froze. I mean, literally, if it had done it. Unless God darkened it without taking the heat away. I mean, just saying. It's not meant to be taken literally. Go ahead.
So, Joseph, in the prophecy that he put forward in his dream, is the same language that is here. This is the sun, moon, and stars.
Bowed down to him.
It is Jacob, the mothers, and the 12 tribes of Israel. And so, if they're darkened, Israel is no more after this. The nation of Israel is gone. It's not there. But it's not that they're wiped away, like they don't exist. It's just darkened. That they don't have a reflection. You don't see them having an influence.
Yeah, well, that's great. I didn't even think about that connection. But if you want to use that connection, it's Israel, the wives, you know, it's the patriarchs, right? Well, that is all talking about national Israel. It's not talking about spiritual Israel.
Right, exactly.
So national Israel is no more. Yes. And there are those out there that would say they actually aren't any more real Jews today because they've been so intermarried that you can't find them. You can't find a true, pure Jew anymore. And another thing they would point to is that when the temple was destroyed, that's where all the genealogies and everything for the Levites were kept. And it would have been destroyed. And they have no way today to know who is a Levite. So they couldn't even reinstitute it if they wanted to. Because they would have a clue. They would need God to reveal that to them again. There's no earthly way for them to figure out who is a Levite now. I'm not saying that. I'm saying somebody I was listening to suggested that. So this is where I'm going to stop. We got a lot, women. We got more coming, but we got more about that day and that hour coming. And that day and that hour is what it's just been talking about. The judgment that arrives that day and that hour. The judgment on Israel. So we've had some good discussion. I don't know if y'all have anything else y'all want to, you want to circle back around to before we wrap up. Anybody?
Well,
because there's a ton for me to talk about. In fact, that's part of, I was like trying to like figure out what of all the stuff we could talk about was, you know, the best talk about with heart.
You mentioned earlier that Luke, there were things that Luke did not include that Matthew did.
No, that's not exactly what I said. I said Luke talks about things earlier in the book.
Like it's something that he mentioned 2 years before this conversation that he's having.
If we take Luke's linear, yeah. Then yeah, I mean, which is sort of the way Luke presents it. But one of the reasons I wanted to point that out, because some people would say because the stuff in 17 is before the stuff in 21, that means that those are two separate events. But Matthew puts them all together in a chronological, you know, he just kind of rolls it out there with no breaks, with no indication that there's this break. That there's this. I'm stopping. I'm talking about a temple here. I'm talking about something else here. Doesn't seem to be that way. It doesn't look like that. It doesn't look like that in Mark either, where he does his. That's why I'm suggesting that while Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, disciples asked the questions, and he did go, boom. I'm just getting the idea that if the disciples had remembered, they might have he'd be hearing some things that were like a little familiar that he might have been talking about. He might have actually already talked about them a little bit before. And now he's adding more to it. He's putting it all together. Because he's fixing not to be around. He's giving them all that. He obviously, divinely prompted, they ask, when will these things take place? Because it's time for them to know. And he tells them a lot. He said, look, this is what you watch for. This is when this is going to happen. But look, you're not meant to be there. You're meant to flee. But you're to get out because this judgment is on Israel, national Israel, in a sense. And you know, and it's like, so it's going to be a while. Here's what you watch for because it's going to be a while before it happens. So you got to be attentive. But it's going to happen in your generation. You will see these things. Not all of them saw it. But that's why, you know, it's like maybe there's more than just the 12 standing there with him when he's talking.